Thank you very much, Linda Ray. I have 15 minutes, and I intend to adhere to that. And I want to say that what I'm going to show is a little flyover of and here's the personal disclosure, and as I learned in Texas, you really should have conflicts of interest, otherwise you can't do business, but I don't have any for this, unfortunately. And I want to also thank the names that you see on top who are our informal guides, including George's Benjamin and a panelist that are helping with the history project. Plus, I want to say that old line, that joke about if you steal from one, it's plagiarism. If you take from many, it's scholarship. So I want to acknowledge my scholarship here, which the Healthy Chicago, the state health department there years ago, and public health as well as the Illinois Public Health Association, and also Erica Salem, who I learned and corresponded with, had done a really nice history of the Chicago Health Department. So this is like Jules Verne's time machine, a flyover rapidly of some of events, Jules Verne's being the H.G. Wells' first kind of sci-fi. And so it'll be brief. It's an experiment for me and our project to try to get some graphic and succinct histories, so this is a very rough cut, that others, and this is an advertisement for the History Project, we need your help and interest, because as our line goes, it's our history and we should be the ones to tell our story. But what I began looking at this, Chicago was founded in 1837, was incorporated. It had a population of 4,400 people in 1840. And by 1870, it was up to just under 300,000. So there's this is in the Library of Congress. It's a lithograph of an overview of what Chicago looked like, and this was in 1857. So I just began thinking, as I often do, in awe of the explosive growth of Chicago and Illinois during these times. Of course, it was not without natural and man-made disasters. The Great Chicago Fire of 1871, which destroyed some 3.3 square miles of Chicago, caused over 300 deaths, and rendered over 100,000 people homeless. And yet, not that they had a choice, it showed something about the resilience of this polyglot city made up of early pioneers, along with the Italian or earlier waves of Irish and Polish, Jewish families, Italian workers that composed the city, and especially as America's heated Horace Greeley's Go West, Young Man, all fueled by railroads. And I wanted to take one line that we all know from Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, is 1859, that it was the best of times and it was the worst of times, because that seems to encapsulate, as it does so often. And in looking at the incredible things that were going on at the time. First of all, I can only imagine the horrors of a cholera epidemic coming upstream somewhere towards Chicago, or smallpox that ravaged the country. And the only thing I could think of was, look what happened in our country, rightfully in many cases, wrongfully in others, to respond to a few cases of Ebola, as serious as that is. Or the West Nile, a joke that I remembered, that when West Nile was first identified in New York City, they said that in a crowded movie theater, someone stood up and yelled mosquito, and there was a huge panic that followed after that. So this, so to think of the terrible, and this is a milieu into which our early workers came trying to really begin to reform health care, and they often were aided, importantly, by citizens groups, by community movements for education, charity, parks. So, for example, Frank Law Olmsted famously, I think he did some work in Chicago, his firm did, but Central Park in San Francisco, he was a member of APHA. So when you start reading the history, you see the number of people who came together. And here, we're going to concentrate on those who worked for building on the nascent boards of health, the social movements, waxing and waning of political efforts, and a huge amount of self-interested political opposition. And then this, the growing body of seeing, say, in Koch and in Pasteur of a growing science. So this was quite a time. And John Lumpkin, who gladly we're going to hear from later, pointed out in the upper left-hand corner, I didn't know who to attribute this cartoon to, and he pointed out to me that the state health department had a cartoonist on staff. And this is one of his cartoons. So I would say I just want to use it as a small illustration of why having multiple inputs to tell our story is so important, that we'll start with a rough fabric and others will help us weave it into a whole. This, what the graphic underneath this is courtesy of UIC School of Public Health, was estimates of the, as you can probably faintly make out, the estimates of the burdens of disease, death rates, in contrasting back in the end of the 19th century to this one was 1999, where the first four of the leading causes of mortality were communicable diseases. Fifth was accident. By 1999, those four were in the chronic conditions that we know. And interestingly enough, number five is still accidents. So it shows the kind of things with building this, as the words up there say, some science, a legal basis, an ethical basis against fatalism, ennui, funding. These are what our worker, both the people I will summarize, but I began to think of the army of public health workers like you and I who stood behind them to carry out all these tasks. And again, just one last little illustration looking at this reconstructed estimates, because there were no accurate mortality data, because that was an early goal of APHA founders, was to have accurate mortality information and information in general. These are the early IT founders. But look at the spikes in that. And there, and you, again, the litany of these causes, cholera, smallpox, reading on down, tuberculosis, and the little spike way at the end under 19, around 1920, is both the flu and the first major polio epidemic in the state. So all of these, I wanted to say the worst of times we've talked about, but the setting the context is so important, like the wonders of the industrial age, along with their downsides, which we'll talk about, mass production, urbanization, communication, and agriculture. The upper left hand is the iconic photo of the meeting of the two railroads, building the first transcontinental railroad at Promontory Point in Utah. That's 1869, post-Civil War. But that shows a little something that I thought about, what enabled APHA to grow. Just the sheer idea that the founder's idea, particularly Stephen Smith, was we had to move the meetings around the country because it was important for local citizens and leaders to get involved. They had to be, the public had to be behind public health. Without the railroads, that would have been impossible. And there are the other wonders, the first dental drill, and obviously a selective one. Pasteur did first applying and using the word immunization. This was for anthrax in bovine settings. And then, of course, Edison and many inventions around that set the tone of really our modern pop culture. The phonograph and his further inventions. So this brings us to our first president from Chicago and Illinois. 1877 was John Rausch. And there have been 9 presidents from Illinois, and there have been 9 meetings, including this one in Chicago, 3 of which overlapped. That is to say, the president and the meeting, we came from Illinois, and the meeting was in Chicago. And John Rausch was one of them. He was, among other things, and I won't lead the litany of accomplishments of this, he founded he was one of the founders of APHA, among the original Hardy Band of 7 who met in 103 Mott Street in New York on April in 1872, and that founded the American Public Health Association. But he also did some other things, like found the Chicago Board of Health, or the one that there had been earlier versions, but one that, and the State Board of Health, and served as presidents of both. He served in the Civil War, and I think that's obviously another important element that most of the founders and early members were obviously very much affected by or involved in the Civil War itself, and this hung over everything in the Reconstruction period and that which followed. So he also, just to cite one other thing, in the outbreak of 1878-79 epidemic of yellow fever, he formed the Sanitary Council of the Mississippi Valley, and as well as looked into the relation of smallpox and immigration. So in saying he's a very unusual person, the year 1877, I want to say, was so tumultuous. A book was written about, a relatively recent book by Michael, Bell Selves, his name is, and his subtitle was American's Year of Violence. And it was, so we're also intimately connected with the social affairs. It's around this time that Samuel Clemens, i.e. Mark Twain, wrote a book, and there's a little picture of the original edition there that we're all familiar, called The Gilded Age. He was the one who first coined that phrase to describe this period of the great gulf of wealth between the haves and the have-nots, and as well as he often did, the political skullduggery and his generally humorous but nevertheless pointed dyspeptic view of a lot of what he saw around him, including race relations. So this was a time, there was the lower illustrations from the Great Railroad Strike. This was one of the worst banking crisis and depressions in American history. And this was there were bloody confrontations, including in Chicago, where B&O rail workers went on strike as they were obliged by management to take their third pay cut. So all of these things, you know, add up to the other side, the both sides of the best of time and the worst of time. And that brings us to our second president, Hose Murray Johnson, from Illinois, 1889. And just look at the litany under the fact that Dr. Johnson apparently had some respiratory conditions that limited his work life, but he managed to get academies of science, history, board of health, astronomical society. Aside from his service in the Civil War, and as I wanted to add, as did Dr. Rausch, both of them were recognized for their work in organizing relief aid after the Great Fire of Chicago. What else happened in 1889? Again, an advertisement for the importance of context for understanding what public health does and how it's affected by and affects what the world around us in our communities. Hull House, being founded by Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr, and that began and built from one a home, the converted mansion, into a complex that was nearly a city block. And I understand it, I think Hull House existed to about 2012 when it closed. And there still is a museum, which I hope to visit before I leave Chicago. Another good resource to think about. But again, this Jane Addams particularly was the mover in this, and again, mostly women who were in the house, but they did everything. I mean, from first public playgrounds to bathhouses to education, reforming ward politics. It sounds like a good agenda for today. And I just wanted to feature in who, when in her autobiography, but our very own Alice Hamilton wrote about how joyful it was for her in 1893 that she became a resident of Hull House and went on from there, shaped by that and, of course, her own feelings to, among other things, to develop the field of toxicology and occupational health, and was a founder of the APHA Occupational Health Section. So as the century turned, the U.S. Census Bureau declared the frontier of the West was closed. Some of which I've been trying to investigate is that rather than the picture of a wild West of everything, that West is often fairly well organized and urbanized. Rural, yes, but also very very urbanized. Of course, the West was developed largely with the aid of the U.S. government. And who paid the price for it were, of course, the indigenous Native Americans who were displaced, removed, and had their culture quashed. But again, this was a time of incredible energy of the haves and the have-nots. Just a few things that were first invented and appeared in that year was Herman Hollerith got the first patent for a mechanical tabulating machine, which went on to become IBM. First, I learned the dishwashing machine was marketed in Chicago, and that's the start of changing all of the way household labor and created opportunities. So all of these things, including the fact that Nellie Bly made her first trip around to the reporter, made her first trip around the world in not in 80 days, but in under 73 days. So a few last things. First of all, the Columbia Fair here, lit by electricity of the Columbian Fair of 1893, the auditorium building that still stands. And here was a picture of traffic jams. It was this time of reform and also a time where Upton Sinclair's book on the jungle, the temperance movement, and these many things and the great developments in terms of the well baby care, safe milk, and pasteurized milk. So third, President W.A. Evans, I'll quickly say, became a syndicated column on how to keep well, among other things. Later went on when he retired to look for prospect for gold in New Mexico and travel the world. Again, another unusual person. And the person that I think many people are attracted to when they read about him is our next president from Chicago, Herman Bundesen, who said outrageous things like providing prophylactics to free and city-funded venereal disease clinics that, among others, the Illinois Medical Journal called revolting, outrageous, and exercise of power. He was dismissed by the mayor, and this the bottom left hand is an editorial in the our journal, and he went on to be elected president. How APHA. But he had the final word, among other things, his infant welfare program that dramatically reduced infant mortality. The mayor who tried to throw him out because he wouldn't disseminate the mayor's political materials in clinics. Bunderson was not to be denied. He went on to run for the coroner of Cook County, and here a picture on the lower left of him as coroner at the scene of the St. Valentine's Day massacre. After the mayor left, the next mayor appointed Dr. Bunderson back, and Dr. Bunderson prevailed overall. Very quickly, the last is Dr. John Porterfield in the 60s. The last that I will speak at any length about is in the 60s, the year of Luther Terry's Surgeon General's report on smoking, the Great Society, civil rights, the war continued in Vietnam and Chicago. Both Chicago and the state were instituting maternal and child health care in keeping with the development of national as well as state. Slide to merely say all these things are intergenerational commitments that we must make, and wondering, is there a 30 or 40 year cycle to this? Are we done yet? No. There's this a graph of AIDS emerging in Illinois and being able, after great times of work, travail, and much unnecessary grief, have been able to begin to turn back the tide of AIDS. The last ones, I want to just render a personal note on some of the presidents that I knew. And the first is Frank Ellis, and I'm sure many of you know Frank or know of him. And the personal reminiscence that I can tell is I asked him, how did the Black Caucus arise? And he told me a bit about it, and he said, you know, somebody should write this down. I'm sure somebody has, but unfortunately I was not one of them. So that made me think. Ira Shannon was a president, and earlier in her APHA career was on the committee for our 100th anniversary. And I would also like to recognize again Quentin Young. And I wanted to have done an honorary appointment of Dr. Caswell Evans, Jr. He now serves Chicago. He now is, and with great distinction, on the, among other things, aside from his faculty appointments, as the Board of Health. And Cas began in his born in the East, developed his career out in California, and I think I decided just average those two up and decided Chicago was the place to be. So I think he deserves great recognition. And last, and among them, obviously far from the least, I just have to say about Quentin Young. He had hurt his ankle when he was in the presidency of APHA. I pushed him around Washington, D.C. a little bit, as did others, and I learned that you could not keep Quentin down, and that's too much to our benefit. And both Linda Ray, who will speak here, and is, admire her eloquence and persistence and being on target, and of course John Lumpkin, our keynote speaker, 12 years as the director of head of the state health department, and now has become a gift to the state of New Jersey, and is a vice president, an executive vice president. The last thing I want to say, times have changed then to now. Our emblems are the pictures. But, you know, and so are the problems, but many of the broad brushstrokes are the same, and that's what we'd like to have in the history problem. And on into the future, I can't do as well as predict the birthplace, of Captain James T. Kirk, scheduled to take place in 2228. And nor do I pretend to, but these organizations that we honor here today and our members and the many other groups and institutions will go on and persist. And I just want to end leaving the final word to our first president, Dr. Stephen Smith, who at age 99 addressed the 50th anniversary of the association he helped found, when he said, "So let us, on this most auspicious anniversary, look backward and learn the lessons of experience which it teaches. Before we take a step into the uncharted future, let us apply ourselves to the task with renewed vigor." So I want to thank you, and supporting health for all in all policy. And please, if you wouldn't mind, if you could leave a sheet of paper at the back or something, if you're interested in the history project, to leave a contact so we can get in touch. This is my last advertisement, and or just take down my email address and send me a note. And I thank you all.